The House Labor Committee, Wednesday, May 30th. Hearing on Senate Bill 228 relating to wage claims. Senate Bill 57 relating to the state merit system. Work session on House Bill 3012 relating to prevailing wage. And Senate Bill 756 relating to polygraph examinations. Immediately following adjournment of the House in the afternoon, a work session will be held on House Bill 3125.
The House Labor Committee will come to order. Clerk will take note of those present. All others are excused. Hearing on Senate Bill 228, Mr. Redden. Bob, do you want to come up also? Anybody else?
Chairman, we have two of the attorneys for my staff are here, but only if you have any questions. And actually, it's a relatively simple bill. At the present time, persons with wage claims against an employer call upon the commissioner of the Bureau for assistance in collecting the wages that are owed. And under the current statutory scheme, the commissioner then attempts to equitably adjust the wage claim controversies between the employer and employee. If that doesn't work, they file suit. Unlike most agencies, there's no binding administrative process. The only remedy for the commissioner with an employer who disagrees with the claim is to file a lawsuit. That requirement means the commissioner resorts to the courts through the Justice Department, and it's both costly and time-consuming. Presently, the commissioner's wage claim conciliation efforts are unsuccessful in approximately 300 cases a year. They are referred to us to begin court action against the employer. This requires a time of approximately 3.6 full-time equivalent attorneys a year. Each attorney, when you realize that each attorney plus support staff costs approximately $110,000, not only realize how expensive we all are, but that it's a change in the procedure to save that time is really worth investigating. These cases, of course, must take their place on the docket, which are crowded at the present time all throughout Oregon, and they're subject to all of the potential procedural delays associated with a court action. Final resolution of the claim can and does take substantial time. 228 represents an alternative to the wage claim process, which will substantially reduce costs, speed settlements, and continue to provide an effective method for resolving wage claim complaints. The bill creates an administrative process permitting the commissioner, after a hearing on the complaint, to issue a binding administrative order. These hearings would be conducted as contested cases under the APA. As in the case with most such agency hearings, any appeal from the commissioner's order would be to the Court of Appeals. Generally, there would be no need for an attorney to assist the commissioner in these hearings. We estimate this procedure would be used in about 60% of those cases which now must be handled through court proceedings. This means 180 claims which now require handling by the department and the courts could be settled administratively by the Bureau of Labor. I want to emphasize that this administrative procedure would supplement rather than replace current means for handling wage claim complaints. The bill has been carefully drawn to protect the rights of both the claimant and the employer. I believe the bill will give the commissioner greater flexibility in handling these complaints and result in faster settlement and lower costs. The bill provides that if the employer desires, desires a trial, that that option is available. The bill on page 3 sets forth the administrative procedures that are put into effect by the bill, and as you can see, they really do take into consideration the rights of both the parties to make certain that we're not doing away with any due process and what is really shortcutting this system by which people collect their back wages. And it's a very simple procedure. If an employee does not get paid, they can now go to an attorney or the labor commissioner. This will enable the labor commissioner in effect to represent that employee and collect those wages in a quicker fashion that's both more efficient and effective for the taxpayer, the employer, and the employee. I might just add that AOI and favors this legislation and as did the Senate and most labor groups that we've talked about.
Before we deal with this, where's my AG's opinion I requested a month ago?
How long ago?
At least a month ago.
Now,
I don't have the very often, I don't have the opportunity to speak, Jim.
It's probably about halfway down.
Which way? Which
direction? The only comment that I would make conversation from doing all his, I'm going to put out to him because he gets the wrong answer.
Well, that's what I'm kind of fed up.
I could add to that, though. You don't have any trouble getting them,
though. Jim, in this, as I read this procedure in Section 4, the appeal from this would go directly to the appeal court.
Court of appeals, right.
So if there's any appeal. Presently, you just go through the court process. Well, that means the circuit court?
Circuit court generally, and then the court of appeals.
Sure, and then the court of
appeals. Potentially Supreme Court.
So this would just substitute the ability to have an administrative procedure.
Right.
In
really
some,
substitutes
in
that
some
for the circuit court. And most I'm advised that most of these claims are not really contested. And under the Administrative Procedures Act, they can, in effect, hand the employer a paper and say, this guy says, yo, do you? And if he doesn't say no, then it means yes, and then they collect it if there are any funds there.
That's
the big problem.
The big problem, because that's some case I'm familiar with. That was, some of the people really didn't get but a few cents on the dollar
right.
Or something like that.
But it's imperative to get a judgment in an event, so.
Yeah. And this.
For the future.
Doesn't affect that either.
Any other questions for the Attorney General?
Just for the record, Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'll say the Bureau of Labor is in support of this. We see this as being a financial savings for the Bureau in terms of costs that we will not have to incur from for Attorney General fees. And we are very much in support of this bill.
Is your budget being cut by that amount, Bob?
We hope not.
That was a close question.
They're coming.
You're going to have some more hearings officers, Bob, are within your present structure, will you be able to handle it?
We think at the time, present time, we can absorb this, and then if we find out otherwise, we will have to add on additional hearing officers. Like I indicated before committee, we will be going to on a contractual basis for hearing officers. So we'll just contract additional hearing officers to cover these also.
I have a question. Tim, it's in your statement, but I think I could ask it of Bob. You use the term equitably adjust, and is that a kind of compromise a claim, or is that trying to find out who's right, who's making a correct statement and who isn't? Is that what that means? The commissioner is limited to attempting to equitably adjust wage claim controversy, like maybe the claimant is claiming more than maybe that person is entitled to, or at least in the opinion of the employer.
Well, I think that's just a, my seed, Bob, I guess that's the statutory language that they may equitably adjust. I mean, she's trying to settle it.
Like if the employee says, well, I got $100 coming, the employee says you don't, then would equitably adjust mean say, well, you settle for $50 or something like that? I don't know what the procedure is in this at all.
Well, I think that what you're saying is just what is fair for both parties. That's basically what our role would be in this area.
And would that involve bringing the parties together at the same time in the same room and saying, hey, you say this and you say this, and
right,
like
that's what we do now.
Uh-huh. Okay, thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much. Yes, Representative Rogers moves Senate Bill 228A and gross to the floor, do pass. Clerk, call roll.
Johnson?
Aye.
Kifori? Riken?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Rogers?
Aye.
Kress?
Aye. Terminal carry. Senate Bill 57, take off your coats. Roll up your sleeves.
Then read the summary.
And read the summary. Senator Day, Mr. Wyatt, and who's representing the governor's office?
Mr. Holster, Department of
Health.
Mr. Chairman, I have a statement from the Association of Engineering Employees of Oregon for the record.
Okay, let me become part of the record. Letter in support of Senate Bill 57 from Leroy Churchill, President, Association of Engineering Employees of Oregon. Senator Dade, would you like to?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, my name is L.B. Day. I'm a state senator from District 16, and I appear in support of Senate Bill 57.
Excuse me, Representative Bajunk. All right. You're here on this one, too. Okay. Would you like to maybe squeeze in? Come up a little closer.
Good job.
Excuse me, Senator Day.
No problem.
We get all the busy legislators up here at one time. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I wanted to give you a little brief background on Senate Bill 57 because it had an interesting history in the Senate. It was introduced at the request of the personnel section of the Executive Department. The Senate Local Government Committee held a hearing on this particular piece of legislation and found it more than wanting. One of the interesting things about the bill was that a number of people had gotten together to determine what the personnel policies should be in the state and how they could patch up the merit system once again in the state government. And they'd failed one interesting test that was to talk to any people who might be affected by it. And there was a great deal of anxiety about it, and so the chairman asked if I would take the time to meet with all the groups affected to see if we could work out something different than what was proposed in Senate Bill 57. We spent about 3 months on that, 2.5 to 3 months, working out, hopefully, something that was more than just patchwork on the merit system. A number of us for the last few years who were involved in collective bargaining for public employees, and I was one of them from the very start. I think the first piece of legislation that I introduced was able to get passed in the House of Representatives was to allow state employees to have collective bargaining agreements if management agreed to it. That was the only thing we could get done at that time, and that was revolutionary in its time. If management agreed to it, then there could be a collective bargaining agreement. And since that time, of course, we've had an evolutionary process over the last 15 years to where in 1973 public employees were granted the right to collective bargaining, and not really a great deal has happened in revamping our merit system laws, what we refer to as a merit system, for at least a 15 to 16 year period. We've passed various patchwork methods in the last 5 or 6 years to hopefully adapt to the times, but we really hadn't taken a hard look at what we want to do. And Senate Bill 57 after meeting with various groups, convinced me and members of the Senate Committee on Local Government that we wanted to do more than just twiddle our thumbs. We really wanted to do a significant job. So Senate Bill 57 is not a housekeeping bill. It is a significant piece of legislation. It takes the position that where collective bargaining exists, that the collective bargaining agreement will be the governing factor. Where the there is no collective bargaining agreement, then in fact there would be some merit system. It allows the executive department and the people who represent through collective bargaining agreements and employees and state agencies a two-year period to develop a system by which if you are represented by a labor organization that you would develop a contract calling for the protections that are called for in the Civil Service Act or the merit system, and if you are not, then a system would be set up to protect those employees who choose not to be represented by collective bargaining. Basically, the philosophy here is that you don't have two bites of the apple, that you're going to, if you're represented by a bargaining agent, then the contract will be the prevailing document. If you're represented by the merit system, then indeed we'll have a revamped merit system. The second principle it takes into effect is the fact that we want to try to stimulate more than just and reward work. Too frequently it's easy to flail away at bureaucrats and to make all the neat statements, particularly in hot political contests, how you're going to sweep the bureaucrats out. But my experience in working with state employees, and I've worked in two state agencies now and helped create two new state agencies and worked in various elements as an executive in the state service, there are many, many people who do excel at their job, and we don't have a method of rewarding those folks. We have, in effect, what they refer to as step increases, but those are longevity pay increases. The only way we reward employees today for excellent service is to try to get them reclassified. That's the system that's used for meritorious service. And the bill suggests that we set up some type of incentive system. Two or three representatives, and I've forgotten who they are here in the House, have an incentive pay bill that's pending to look at. This would complement what we're trying to do in Senate Bill 57, is to set up that type of incentive system. The third thing we're trying to do is to ensure that grievances are adjudicated, that when a grievance arises, that it doesn't take 5 years to resolve it. I'll just share with you a story that happened to me in the DEQ. We had a chemist who felt that he had the opportunity to tell his supervisor to go jump in the lake, in more colorful terms than that. So I went through all the procedures of telling that, you know, that really isn't conduct permissible. Even a Teamster telling that, that probably had credibility, but I tried to persuade him. And had an awfully time, put him on probation, and he was all right during his probationary period. As soon as he was off probation, he told the guy to go jump in the lake, and so I finally fired the individual. It took a year and a half to resolve that. During that period of time, the vacancy of this chemist had to keep that job vacant and could not fill it because of a pending appeal. And it would just seem to me it's a poor way to run a railroad. There ought to be some way to resolve a dispute in a shorter period of time. Those of you who are experienced in collective bargaining know that if you're really working a grievance procedure correctly, there's no reason that you can't have some solution within between 90 and 120 days where you can either be at final and binding arbitration or you have the matter settled. So we're trying to wind into this system a way to handle those everyday grievances once the collective bargaining agreement has been agreed to, how we can beef that up. I think last but not least, we're also speaking of a system that hasn't really, it doesn't complement itself. You can't have two systems where you have two sets of rules, and every time someone tries to work out a collective bargaining agreement, they say, oh, well, you can't do that because the merit system over here interferes. The employees organizations and so forth find that cumbersome, and so does the executive. I think that the whole thrust of this legislation is to address ourselves to the fact that we have many, many fine employees that work in the state of Oregon. We want to design a system that will be more responsive to their needs, that will reward them for services well done, and for those who don't do a good job, there's a method by which we can dispose of their cases with a due process, that they receive fair treatment, but the fact that we dispatch those who don't produce. I think that, in essence, is what we're trying to affect in Senate Bill 57. I want to apologize because the explanation of this entire bill will take a bit, but that is the heart of the bill. That's the reason it's here. It has the support of Governor Attia, who personally attended, and I know that he can't be, he's in Boise today, or he'd have been here personally, because he's taking a personal interest all the way through. I think we have one amendment that the State Employees Association and the Executive Department are going to offer. We, at the last minute, beefed up the section on civil rights, and we wanted to, we're not sure that we did all the things we should have done, so we have there's a small amendment that they want to offer to see what we can do to make ensure that's there. We've cleared this particular legislation with the federal government on the civil or on the Civil Service Commission, where we meet the standards, and they say we do meet the standards of a merit system with this bill. So we've had their regional clearance, and I can say that the bill came out of the local government committee 7-0, and it passed the Senate without a dissenting vote. So we really have tried to present you with a piece of legislation that we're extremely proud of, and Representative Zajon, who has worked with me through this entire affair, I think we've wrung our hands and our brow has sweat more than once, but I think we've delivered a product that we can tell you that I think will be meritorious and help state employees do a better job in the same time and ensure that they have protection and will have their problems and grievances handled in a judicious way. And at this time, maybe Representative Zajon, but I'd be glad to answer any questions. The technical aspects of this, I'll be glad to get into. I have my experts on my right and left and two or three behind me, so we're ready to go.
Might say, Senator Day, that we do have the statement by the governor.
Okay.
Relating to the bill and become part of the record, too.
And I might add, I don't know of any of the employees' organizations that are, they are wholeheartedly in support of this. They have testified on numerous occasions and have assisted. I have had no adverse mail, to my knowledge, on it. I think people feel that we are trying to attempt at something more significant work on it. The act won't take final effect until 2 years from now, so the legislature will have another shot at it, but it gives us 2 years to work towards it, and it sets the stage.
Okay, before we get into questions, Representative Zajon, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Donna Zajon, District 32. There were just a few comments I wanted to make. Senator Day has already touched on a number of them, so I won't go over them. But I think the most important thing is how I grew into this, and it's my district, which is the downtown area in East Salem area, is made up of about 30-35% of state workers. And in campaigning and getting to know more of the problems of my district, you know, I very quickly learned of what I think is a misnomer, and that is that there's merit in the merit system. And the second misnomer, a very popular belief, is that state workers like the civil service system as it's working currently. And I think that's wrong. Certainly, every necessary means must be taken to protect workers, and I think this bill does that. However, the problem is that, you know, we have just thousands of outstanding workers that are being pulled down in a bureaucratic maze, gives them no incentive, no encouragement to grow, no means to move upward, and no method for increased financial reimbursement other than through reclassification. Now, that, I think, is an extreme detriment to our workers, to our managers, and to the citizens of the state that are asking very reasonably to have some sort of service, and that service can be better given, in my opinion, through the outcome of Senate Bill 57. I wanted to specifically make some very positive comments about certain parts of the bill, and we might do that as we go through it, but I think the parts that I'm most excited about are the arbitration, or the grievance procedures process, that I think is going to expedite the grievance procedure. On page 9, there's a section that deals with the whistleblower, what I call the whistleblower amendment. I wanted to individually introduce this myself, and this is a very appropriate place to make sure that it's included, and just basically says, top of page 10 is the language. It says, the division shall establish a procedure whereby employees may report wrongdoing or inefficiency. This is going on time and time again right now. We want to encourage it. Any of you who have spoken to Secretary of State Norma Paulus, you know that this is a very important means of how she is getting information from state workers. We want to continue that, and this section gives protection to state workers.
Donna, I'm sorry, I don't know where you are.
Top of page 10, line...
Okay.
Yes.
Page 10, line...
Page 2, line 3, 4. Or that whole subsection 5.
Okay.
Gives the protection to the state workers.
Okay, I just wasn't clear.
That comes forth and gives cases of inefficiency, corruption, whatever.
This is what you referred to as the whistleblower.
That's what some of us call the whistleblower section.
That's the correct term.
Well, you went very quickly from you said the best part of the grievance procedure, and then went right to that without very much discussion of the grievance procedure.
That's true, and I did it just for the sake of time. I was just listing certain sections that I think are the most exciting part about the bill. I was going to go on to say the merit pay system, and what Senator Day has already spoken about is the increased accountability on both sides to what should be a professional approach to collective bargaining. And both Senator Day and I believe that this bill does that. Representative Rogers, I just wanted to list a number of things, and maybe I misled you by just quickly going over them, but those are sections I'm very excited about. Thanks.
A little later, I'd like to get in a little discussion on that, because I think it's fantastic too, and I can relate to it very well, and knowing some people that maybe months back that I was talking to that blew a whistle, and there was certainly retaliation.
I
have some questions about some of the legal things here, but we'll get into that.
I guess if I just make a last comment, and that is what, from time to time when we started working on this bill, you hear a great deal of fear that we can't allow this kind of thing to happen in the public sector. And that there's a fear that the public sector cannot take on the collective bargaining process that has worked for many decades in the private sector. I think it's time to really approach collective bargaining in a professional manner and to make both parties sit down at the table in a very equal setting. Again, I think this bill does.
Are there any questions at this time? I don't know what your schedules are, Senator Day.
What I'm going to do is turn over these two gentlemen, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you have. I help with technical amendments too, but they're going to go through it chapter and verse for you, and I'll be glad to come back anytime. I think I just leave you with a thought that I believe the collective bargaining process in the state has worked. I think the Public Employees Bargaining Act, I recall all sorts of predictions of that it was going to create all sorts of havoc. I think, if anything, it's created a great deal of stability. And this is just the next step that we determine that, how you approach it. So I appreciate the courtesies, and if there are any direct questions, I'll be glad to answer them shortly.
I have a question for Representative Zajac on the whistleblower language. I was having a little trouble reading in line 4 That language is between the commas. I was having a little trouble reading that into the context of that sentence. And maybe you can explain that.
Well, just explain the intent there, Representative.
Let's see. The division shall establish a procedure whereby employees may report wrongdoing or inefficiency to an independent agency. That's fine, comma. And then the next, prohibitions and protection against employee reprisals. I don't understand.
I think you have, to go back to the division to establish a procedure whereby employees
may report
wrongdoing.
Prohibitions and protections against employees.
And I think the intent is that they will establish procedures on prohibitions and protections against employee reprisals. I don't think it is a little cumbersome, and maybe some short and small change to draw them two together.
Yeah, okay.
It's primarily the procedure for the protection.
Mm-hmm. I understand what it's getting at, and I think it's very good.
Okay, are there any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Who would like to start off?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Bill Wyatt, representing the Oregon State Employees Association. I think what I'd like to do is just make a couple of very preliminary comments, and Mr. Holscher will then do the section-by-section analysis of the bill and do this pretty much as we did before the Senate committee with an occasional clarifying comment. Both of us have put in, along with an awful lot of other people, a considerable amount of time on this, so if occasionally we lose you in the morass of details, be sure and let us know, because as you, I suspect, are aware, you've been so involved in something, you kind of forget that not everyone else has either been that involved or has the degree of interest that you do. Just to amplify on Senator Day's comments, the measure has received just an enormous amount of attention by a variety of the parties involved. Three of the unions representing state employees, the governor's office, representatives of the personnel division, and various agency representatives have been involved in lengthy debates and, frankly, negotiations on various provisions of the bill. I don't know how many official work sessions this bill has had in the Senate Local Government Committee and the subcommittee, but no doubt a considerable number. I recall sitting down with our staff at OSCA prior to the session saying, you know, this may be the time when we want to consider divorcing ourselves from the merit system. So we began a study, clause by clause, of every of the 50 contracts that we had with the state and the merit system, identifying the source of authority for each of those clauses and whether it conflicted with the merit system or personnel division rules or whatever. Fairly exhaustive study, and then things seemed to slow down, and all of a sudden, almost overnight, Senate Bill 57 introduced, and we began the process, which ultimately led us here. Our goal, frankly, with this bill is to create, as nearly as possible, a singular system of personnel administration, which has its foundation in the process of collective bargaining. And we have come to believe very much in that process, and I think what occurred on Friday with a tentative agreement on a substantial new contract for the coming year, and I don't know if any of you were able to see the Statesman editorial on it this morning, very pleased to see a favorable editorial comment on the subject, but I think that occasions as that prove that the process does work and does work very well. The problems that we've had in the past few years, frankly, are the conflict between the merit system and the rules promulgated as a result of that system and the process of collective bargaining. And our attitude is two simply don't work together. And we would like to divorce, as nearly as possible, those two systems and operate under the one which we know and like the best, which is the process of collective bargaining. I think this bill approaches that. as well as possible. It does meet the test of the federal requirements, which are required as a result of the Intergovernmental Personnel Administration, requiring that state programs which receive certain specified grant and aid programs, monies, do adhere to various merit principles, and those principles are enumerated in this measure. And we've done that. The federal government has said, fine, we like the looks of this, and it does comply with our requirements. And I think probably at this point it would be appropriate to just start page one, line one, and go through the measure. And for that, Mr. Holscher. Okay.
Representative Crest, members of the committee, I'm William F. Holscher, Assistant Attorney General and Counsel. I represented the state in all legal labor relations matters since the passage of the Oregon Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, and I've also represented the state relative to merit system matters. I've been asked to bring the governor's message that you mentioned, Representative Crest. You have it in front of you in written form. I won't take your time to read it because we've got a lot of ground to cover, but the governor specifically would have been here today for this bill had he not been out of the state. And I call your attention when you get a chance to read his remarks in full that he, in his campaign, was concerned with improving the efficiency of state employees and recognized that this is a twofold problem. One, it's the problem of managing state employees to use their time to the best interests of the service, and the second, to encourage state employees to individually, without management, use their time to the best interests of the service through merit compensation. The bill that, as Bill Wyatt has said, has been written, negotiated, rewritten, and perfected, we think, is a sweeping piece of legislation in that it does not in any way, shape, or form attempt merely to amend the existing merit system, but rather to do away with a bulk of the archaic and finite rules that had been built up in the merit system over a 20-year period, to preserve what, as Bill said, is required by the federal government in terms of a merit system meeting federal standards, also to preserve merit principles so that the protections of employees against political kinds of decisions, arbitrary political decisions, are still there, and yet to free both management and labor from the 20-year-old set of statutes and rules and standards that prevented the development of systems which truly management could manage and which would truly give employees more reason to want to be meritorious, specifically with regard to merit compensation. One last comment on the governor's written remarks to you. He proposed in the Senate committee a specific merit compensation pay scheme, a compensation merit compensation package, which I think is still in committee. And it's there because essentially the unions who represent state employees would rather negotiate the finite details of that plan than to have it preset by legislation. I can tell you that included in Senate Bill 57, the amendments to Senate Bill 57, which you have before you, is sufficient statutory authority for the state to negotiate exactly the same kind of merit compensation plan that we had proposed finitely in the amendments, which are still back in the Senate committee. And I think that the success we've had in the current negotiations give us reason to believe that by July 1, 1981, we will have a compensation plan that is truly meritorious, if not before that date. Going through the bill in section by section, we have repealed a number of sections from the current ORS Chapter 240, which are simply believed to be no longer necessary. They are either archaic sections which were never used, or they are sections which will be replaced by the relationship between the parties in collective bargaining. The statute maintaining certain merit principles for the parameters of that collective bargaining rather than the finite sections which are being repealed. Section 2 is a question of definition, and Section 2 changes the name of the statute from the state merit system law to the state personnel relations law, and the reason for that change is that we view this statute not merely as a merit system, but a statute which governs the personnel relations of state employees by a combination of merit system and collective bargaining. Section 3 eliminates some finite specifications of the purpose of the chapter, and simply indicates that the purpose of this chapter is to establish a state system of personnel administration based on merit principles. Section 4 goes into the definitions and eliminates a number of definitions that are no longer necessary because the subject matter of the phraseology has been eliminated by repeal from the Act. Section 5 refers to the duties of the Employment Relations Board, which, as you know, is both the Labor Relations Board of this state for public employees as well as the Review Board for Merit System Matters under Chapter 240. The elimination of certain material from the duties of the board again go to sections that will no longer be necessary because of the repeal of other sections and the replacement of some of those matters by collective bargaining. The significant part of Section 5 is the addition of responsibility to the Employment Relations Board through subsection 2, which talks about the review and enforcement of arbitration awards involving employees in certified or recognized appropriate collective bargaining units. At the moment, it is an unfair labor practice under the Collective Bargaining Act, or as Chapter 243-650, for either labor or management to refuse to go to arbitration if they've agreed to do so, or to refuse to obey an arbitration award. But the board did not have statutory authority to review arbitration awards except in the unfair labor practice context. And we think that since we want speedy resolution of grievances, we want speedy resolution of disputes between the parties on interpretations of contract matters, we don't want to go through the lengthy unfair labor practice routine. And this section says that those arbitration awards are binding on both parties unless one side or the other makes an appeal to the Employment Relations Board directly, claiming one of the statutory A through G standards has been violated by the arbitrator.
Chairman, I just point out a couple of things. I think this is a very significant section because so often you hear and read about grievances winding their way down the road for years and years and years and years, the intent that we put this together with the idea in mind that we would get a speedy resolution of those, speedy, swift, final, and just resolution of those grievances. And we also used the language in this arbitration provision here, sub 2 of section 5, which comes almost directly out of the commercial arbitration statute in chapter 33. And the purpose of that is to allow the Employment Relations Board to use Court of Appeals precedent decisions in deciding what certain words mean and in looking at this with the thought in mind of reviewing awards, just exactly what their latitude is. So they have a lot of case law to work with there.
Yeah, I would agree with Bill that A through G come out of ORS Chapter 33, which is the Uniform Arbitration Act. The Court of Appeals said that Chapter 33 did not apply to public employee collective bargaining arbitration. So we've taken the standards of 33 and placed it into this section of the Act so that the ERB can review arbitration awards on exactly the same grounds that the courts would review similar arbitration of private parties. And as Bill said, the precedential value of the cases that the court has had will be usable by the ERB. Of course, all decisions of the ERB are directly appealable to the Court of Appeals, so there's a consistency in this amendment. Section 6 relates to, again, the matter of review of arbitration awards and indicates that the arbitration award review by the Employment Relations Board is the exclusive remedy. There is no other place to go to review an arbitration award except the Employment Relations Board and, of course, on appeal from the Employment Relations Board to the Court of Appeals. Section 7 relates to the appointment of the director of the Personnel Division, who's currently appointed through a rather elaborate procedure with lists being made up by the Employment Relations Board and with the advice and approval of the Senate. And this places, we think, the appointment of the administrator of the Personnel Division to be appointed and hold office at the pleasure of the director of the Executive Department. We have similar in another section provided for the appointment of a director of labor relations who would serve at the pleasure of the director of the executive department, and we see those two functions as separate but somewhat parallel, and both should serve at the director of the pleasure of the director of the executive department, who has the ultimate responsibility for both merit and labor relations of state employees. Section 8 amends ORS 241.23 to speak to the duties and powers of the board, specifically with regard to the power that the board currently has to employ a staff counsel. The phrase, however, the general counsel shall not appear before the board in any capacity other than general counsel to the board, unquote, was added at the request of the labor representatives on the basis that I have represented the Employment Relations Board for lo these many years as related to city and county employees and not as related to state employees, because I also have to appear before the board. And the board has never employed a staff general counsel. They've always been represented by the Attorney General's office. If they do, and we hope they will, employ a general counsel, this phraseology would make it impossible for that individual to appear before the board in any other capacity. I think it's necessary because it isn't entirely possible that they might employ a private practitioner on a part-time basis to act as general counsel, and they would not want that individual representing someone for whom there would be a conflict of interest.
Chairman.
Representative Rogers.
On line 22,
is that word however necessary? What does that however relate to?
It just says that the general counsel may represent the board in any litigation or other matter pending in a court of law to which the board is a party or otherwise interested. And then, of course, it's a however proviso. I think however would not be necessary.
Well, that's why there's nothing to modify with however. The phrase, the general counsel shall not appear before the board, is all by itself. And I just wondered if I was missing something.
Maybe in the heat of the negotiation, we've added one too many words.
That must have been your language.
Yes.
Okay.
In Bill's mind, you added more than one too many words. He doesn't like the sex neutralizing.
By the way, all of these sex neutralizing words were not added by either Bill or I, but by the Legislative Council.
Yay.
I'm not against that sort of thing. I just don't think of it in those terms. Section 9 goes again into the duties of the administrator of the personnel division and essentially eliminates many of the finite previous responsibilities and gives him simply the general powers to carry out the duties, functions, and powers of the personnel division left under the chapter. The most significant part of this section is in, I would go on then to Section 10. Section 10 relates to the classification plan. There are two aspects of classification. The first is someone has to decide what classifications there will be in state service. We currently have 1,070 different classifications of employees. The second is that someone must allocate each position, each chair, each desk into one or more of those classifications. Dual function has been performed in the past by the personnel division, and that has caused no great problem because the personnel division would get a request from an operating agency to allow this particular desk to be an administrative number 4, and the personnel division would say it was a number 3, and many months would ensue while there were desk audits and so forth, and the administrative agency would not be able to plunge forward. In this draft, in this bill, we have indicated that the allocation of positions within the various operating agencies to classifications in the classification plan shall be performed by the agency appointing authority with post-audit review by the division. We feel that if the appointing authority has the position, if the appointing authority has the budget, then the appointing authority ought to make the allocation to the job that it feels best suits this position. If duties are changed, then of course there'll be a reallocation of the position, and if emergency board approval is required by reason of funding or the number of budgets, so then it's up to the operating agency to take care of that problem. The course gave the personnel division authority to post-audit review to keep some track of the use of these classifications in state service. I think this will remove one of the major complaints that both administrators and employees have had with the former merit system.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
When it comes to establishing those classification levels, if you wish, if the agency can do that, do we risk ending up with everybody rising to the top like cream? And then having a problem when the audit comes along and having to go through the procedure that you've set here to get them to the levels that... In other words, who's going to establish whether the level is valid, and how do we ensure that this audit will, in fact, be implemented? Just because you not have an audit, we have all kinds of audits that say something is wrong, but nothing ever happens. And I worry that I want to be sure that we have something that says somebody has some final authority to establish that. Can you tell us?
a representative, there's a specific section, the number of which escapes, and we'll hit it as we go through, which
that
indicates
directly to this item.
Well, there are several areas where we have given the personnel division post-audit authority. And so there's a general section which says that any dispute between an operating agency and the personnel division arising out of a post-audit okay. will be resolved by the director of the executive department.
Thank you.
And I see, relative to the matter of jobs floating to the top, number one, if the employee believes he or she is misclassified, there is the grievance procedure and an ultimate determination by the Employment Relations Board on the matter. If the agency overclassifies, then there is the ultimate power of the emergency board, both through the funding as well as through the number of positions. I see it really as hopefully a tool to better management. We may have two positions which are both underclassified, in which the employee is being misused, and we might want to combine those two positions and create a higher level position and do away with one job. And to wait many months for desk audit reviews and that kind of thing is simply silly, because the duties and the responsibilities of these agencies change so fast, depending on workload, that they need that flexibility.
It's to the point.
You referred to the emergency board two or three times. The Ways and Means sets the budget
yes.
when they pass it.
Yes.
So if they want to change classification upward on one of these, the legislature, once the budget had been established, then they would have to go to the emergency board and get approval to do that.
Yes, a specific statute on that matter, that change in budget or change in classification.
If it costs more money.
If it costs more money.
Mm-hmm. This is a real significant section, I think, because I know that when I first came to OSCA, there were people who had, for whatever reason, thought they were not working in the proper classification, and there are a variety of reasons, applied for a reclassification job upwards. They felt they were doing the job one step or two steps up, and might have been 2 or 3 years since that application was initially made, and never heard of it, never heard back on it. That process has changed a little bit. It still can take up to 6 to 9 months before you can complete that whole process. And that's not to anyone's advantage.
In fact, I remember some bill last session dealt with reclassification.
Good
just
bill.
Vaguely.
I think from my 5 or 6 years of experience with this, that this, as Bill said, is one of the more significant sections, and I think it will put the responsibility back on agency administrators to not only make the allocations, not only spend the money, that is, spend their budgets, but make the allocations and make them both within budget and within the parameters set forth by the personnel division. There is a small amendment which allows Section 11 goes to the unclassified service and lists who those unclassified service individuals are, and on page 6, line 13, subsection 16 refers to CETA employees. And the phrase has been added, however, persons employed under this section shall be treated as classified employees for the purposes of 243-650 at SEC, which is the Collective Bargaining Act. The purpose of this phraseology is that in our agencies now, we have both unclassified CETA employees, other unclassified employees, of course, and classified employees. We have never negotiated unclassified employees, negotiated for unclassified employees and classified together, because they have different obligations under the merit system. Unclassified CETAs, however, by federal statute, are to be given the same terms and conditions of employment as other employees, with two exceptions. The first is retirement, and the second is layoff. You may not lay off a regular employee and keep a CETA. The CETAs have to go first. So we believe that we can handle the layoff and the retirement matters through the other statute and through collective bargaining and go ahead and bargain for CETA employees as if they were classified employees, even though technically they're unclassified.
You didn't mean that you have an amendment to this bill. You
know,
talking about the new language.
Exactly.
In 60.
The purpose of the new language.
I might, for everybody's edification, I think there's one small amendment that's going to be proposed. And
we'll get there soon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
On page 8.
Yeah, I should say that I think we'll straighten up that one section a little bit, the terminology or the way it's structured in that earlier section.
On the whistleblower.
Yeah.
Section 12 relates to the amendment of 240-235, which is the merit pay section. In the amendments that the governor made in the Senate committee, we had proposed a merit pay plan that had no steps. There would be a minimum rate and a maximum rate, but no steps in between, so that administrators could grant pay based strictly on individual performance without regard to time, and not be forced to grant increases based on time but without the meritorious performance. Further, there was a section that allowed for retroactive monetary awards for past services rendered. That is, every 6 months employees could be reviewed and a certain number of them in each agency could be granted some retroactive award for the services rendered during the past 6 months. That's the specifics of that plan, as I said, did not come out of committee. We expect to be negotiating on it. This amendment sets forth that there will be a merit pay system which will take into account individual performance and organizational accomplishment, prevailing rates of pay for the services performed, and for comparable services in public and private employment, living costs, maintenance, other benefits received, obligations established by collective bargaining agreements, and the state's financial conditions and policies. The last sentence reads, the merit pay system may provide for monetary awards to employees for past meritorious service and contribution to the mission and goals of the employment agency. We think that this...
Mr. Chairman, could I ask a question, sir? Okay, I'll go ahead. There must be a reason for the word in line 26, living costs, that has a special meaning.
Well, I think we have always taken into account in our collective bargaining negotiations, and I think previous to collective bargaining, the personnel division always took into account in making the compensation plan, and I dare say the legislature took into account what was happening in terms of inflation.
Okay, when it says the division shall establish and implement a merit pay system, which shall, and take into consideration. But it would seem to me that the merit pay situation would be totally aside, the living cost thing, unless it was unless there was a special high cost in Timbuktu, in Eastern Oregon to live, that living cost would not enter into the issue of merit pay. It's just that's why I wondered, is there a special reason why you, maybe my understanding of merit pay is different than yours?
I think that this section 235 encompasses more than just merit pay. In fact, this used to be, you can see with the deleted language, was the exclusive authority on which the state based its ability to pay people, period, for whatever they did. It was called merit pay because that was one of the principal bases of that structure. In fact, it's not, but that's what was intended. Merit is intended as the principal structure in this plan. Living costs, frankly, in terms of a regional issue, has not really been taken into consideration in any of the negotiations that I'm aware of.
That's why I wondered if this was at all necessary or
well,
if there was a specific reason.
There
was a specific reason I'd want to know what it meant.
Could you have a situation where a state employee could be transferred from one area to the other?
We do.
Living costs
Yes,
okay, well, it would be much higher in any other area.
Correct. And we also
But do you accommodate those people now in any form?
Yes.
Yes.
Give me an example then.
Registered nurses within the Portland metropolitan area receive an increased differential, something in addition to what registered nurses are paid in other parts of the state. One, because of supply and demand, and secondly, partially based on living costs.
So registered nurses,
that's what I wanted as an example. I could understand that we aren't mixing the negotiations for salaries with merit pay, that we have something separate here.
No,
is that your intent, or am I wrong?
I think Bill is entirely right that this is the old compensation pay section in which you had to take into account the starting rates for comparable private and public business in order to remain competitive. You also had to take into account, of course, cost of living problems. And what we've really done is add to this section considerations that will place the compensation of employees more on the basis of merit than on the passage of time. So the idea, at least from the executive department standpoint, is the way you will get from the starting rate to the top rate will be based on merit. But of course, in order to keep the whole system competitive, we've got to move top rates and starting rates along with either competition or along with cost of living. Of course, collective bargaining will make us do that regardless.
Oh, sure. It seemed to me that that's, if we're going to have a merit plan, unless there's something wrong with my understanding what merit pay means, we've covered every single thing that you negotiate for is in this paragraph.
Yes.
Including
economically.
Yes. Including part of the old statement, ability to pay, which I never supported.
Everything in salary.
Yeah.
But there are millions of other little factors that you enter into.
Sure, but you haven't missed anything in that paragraph.
You may not believe this, but I didn't write it.
Okay.
No, I wrote it.
You wrote it?
As a matter of fact, to Representative Johnson, I see the paragraph as much a management aid as a union aid, in the sense that when bargaining demands are made to us, I expect them to be within the parameters of the way in which this is described. And I expect to rely back on the very same factors, but on a negative way. That is, if the unions ask for 53%, I would point out that the cost of living's only gone up X amount.
But
the competition has only gone up X amount.
I'd like to see the other amendments that were omitted from the bill.
Oh, the merit pay.
What came out? You indicated that something came out in the
didn't sentence. Come out. It just was not adopted.
It was never adopted. Now that related specifically to merit pay in the sense of a minimum rate and a maximum rate and no steps and the ability to grant X number of employees in each agency retroactive awards up to so much percent, and it had a lot of finite details.
Maybe
there.
I don't want to see it. now you're getting the message,
Mr. Chairman. I would also like to point out. One of the things that we agreed to, I think Bill alluded to this earlier, in our tentatively agreed to contract, is that by July 1 of 1980, that's correct, immediately both sides will appoint a committee of 8, 4, and 4 to develop a merit pay system. And I think there's a mistaken impression that we're opposed to pay on the basis of merit. And that's not correct. The problem that we have with the current system and with the proposed new system is that the economic valve which regulates this whole system is a very unsuccessful and highly subjective evaluation process, which I think has consistently been proven to be unsuccessful, in that it does not accurately evaluate people on the basis or the relative ability to do the job. And that's really where the work needs to be done here in the next year to 2 years, is on that process, so that people can feel comfortable, A, that they're going to be evaluated on the basis of their performance, and B, if they think they've got a gripe, that they can take their gripe somewhere and get an answer. So it's not the merit issue, it is how that merit is determined, really, which is the major.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, though, that we should, as we go through this, keep in the back of our mind that this is a hybrid, and that we have really neither a merit system or a pure collective bargaining system, but a integrated, compatible hybrid that everybody feels is going to work, management and labor.
I think, Representative Crest, your point's well taken that there are some employees in state service, of course, who aren't represented, who could be represented. There are 3,500 individuals who are in supervisory and confidential capacities, and this statute gives us the statutory authority to treat those people unilaterally without the collective bargaining process. Of course, we also have the collective bargaining process for the majority of state employees.
But it also gives those that are not members of the bargaining unit protections, too.
Yes, statutory protection, that their rates will be based on these factors. And as Bill pointed out, we have in this collective bargaining agreement that is now up for ratification by the OSCA a specific section that obligates the parties, both management and labor, to develop a merit pay plan by July 1st,
1980.
Okay, to pursue that discussion a little bit, because this language in lines 24 through 29 do in two places speak to merit considerations, on line 25, and again in the last sentence on 28 and 29, couldn't that subsection be reworded to just delete the two places where it says merit pay and insert compensation? So a compensation system would take into these consideration, these merit considerations, and also the economic things too. It would
only if you wanted to give me a heart attack.
I don't want to do that. I fought tooth and nail to keep the words merit pay system in this bill for the reason that I'm now faced with the collective bargaining obligation, you know, to develop a merit pay system. I tried to get it developed in the Senate committee and failed, and now I'm going to try to do it at the collective bargaining table.
Words had much more.
Don't take out the words merit pay system from what is essentially the development of a compensation plan, because I think at least how you get from the bottom rate to the top rate ought to be on the basis of merit, even if we set the bottom and the top rates based on other factors.
Real pride of authorship here.
I was just trying to get at Representative Johnson's question there, so it didn't come up again, maybe the parts of that section, that subsection that say merit pay could be separated from those that are the economic things. Maybe make two sentences out of it or something.
I think Bill,
the union is really not are not opposed to merit pay plans, and we want employees to realize that while we're giving them competitive salaries, that is beginning and top rates that are competitive, and maybe even some system for special retroactive awards, depending on how successful we are in the negotiations, that we want to negotiate something and establish something that employees will realize that climbing from the bottom to the top will be based on individual performance and not the mere passage of time. That's why we want the merit pay words in there. So please don't take them out.
that new language should be a subsection one, I think, too. I think that's omitted.
You're right. The brackets have been put around in the wrong spot. We should move the bracket.
Okay.
So in front of the one in the...
I deleted the subsection one.
I'm moving along then.
That should be the door. Okay.
Section 13 relates to some amendments which were originally in 57 concerning officers and employees who go to the military service and return to state service and limit the
period of time to 4 or 5 years that they may come back to their jobs, depending on whether their duties was at the request of the federal government or otherwise, and amends the veterans law, not Chapter 240. We simply put them in these amendments because we essentially, by these amendments, repealed everything else that was in the original Senate Bill 57. Section 14...
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
at that point? We're saying, let's see, that they can be reinstated as long as military duty does not exceed 4 years, right? And then the condition that if duty is extended at the request of and for the convenience of the federal government, maybe like in time of war or something like that, or maybe there's other extenuating circumstances, it could go for 5 years.
Yes.
Now, what are now, it's been so long, what is the term in the Marine Corps or the Navy anymore, or the Air Force? And it used to be there was a 4-year term.
Pardon?
Hitch, right?
Four
is it still four?
Mm-hmm. That's my knowledge, Representative Chris. They keep changing that. You know, if you'll sign up for 9, we'll send you to college. And I think the state has no control over the...
That I agree with. I'm just wondering, though, just a regular enlistment, if that term is not... It's 4 years. Isn't that right, Bill?
There's only one other comment I could make to you on this section. I really didn't study this section because I wasn't concerned with what old Senate Bill 57 had in it as opposed to what we wrote new. But since the Vietnam Veterans Readjustment Act of 1974, state employees have now been covered by the Federal Veterans Reemployment Act, and as far as I know, this is on a parallel with the federal requirements.
Okay, so that would cover anybody that was serving that 4-year hitch. That's important. Yeah.
But if you re-up for a year to complete a term in a foreign...
Well, then the rest of the language in there might even allow it there, right? As long as it wasn't more than 5 years. It exceeds 4 years of the period.
If you have no further questions on 13, Section 14 relates to the ability to name staff employees to act in the name of an appointing authority. As you know, the term appointing authority is that single individual within an agency who has the right to hire and fire. And the statute previously allowed the delegation of that to up to 3 staff members. In some state agencies like corrections, there are more than 3 institutions, so you need more than 3 potentials for delegation. And so all we've done is remove the limitation of 3 and allowed the appointing authority to name certain individuals as having the power to hire or fire. Section 15, which is ORS 240.410, is the trial service removal section. State employees are given a trial service and they're removed if their habits and dependability or willingness and ability to perform their duties do not merit continuation in the service. And as we anticipate collective bargaining, possibly different trial service periods for different kinds of employees, we remove the finite limitations of a 6-month trial service with the removal in the first 2 months only with the approval of the administrator of the personnel division, etc. In other words, trial service is still there, the standards for trial service are still there, but we remove the finite term because for some employees maybe a 2 months is a long trial service, and for others it ought to go a year. Some jobs, not everything happens the first year.
Then there's no end to it at all. I mean, that's kind of wide open.
And I think the unions in their collective bargaining will make certain there is an end at which a person will have passed their trial service. I'm hoping in a couple of cases to make it longer than 6 months, and maybe they're hoping in a couple of cases to make it less than 6 months.
Is that variable in the current negotiation?
Well, yes. It is, because the law right now says up to 6 months. Or it doesn't. We went through that once before.
Appreciate that these amendments take place July 1st, 81, so it's in the next 2 years that we'll be negotiating most of this.
It has not yet been the subject of negotiation.
Oh, okay, it's not a part of any bargaining agreement now.
No.
What this law will say, I think we get to it here somewhere, is that there will be a trial service period, the length of which to be negotiated, and I think Bill said it correctly, for lesser skilled positions, you really don't need a long trial service period. For positions requiring greater skill, you may need a longer trial service period to properly evaluate this person before you can determine whether or not you want them to continue. And that, I can assure you from our point of view, at least, will be the subject of negotiation.
Section 16 relates to 244.30, which is the...
I would ask you a question before you go.
Please.
Why are you willing to give up the prerogative of how long the trial service will be?
Well, speaking on behalf of management, at the bargaining table, I don't see this statute as giving up any management prerogatives. Rather, I see it as giving us a great deal more latitude to accomplish matters which we think are necessary for good management. As an example, by doing away with a mandatory statutory 6-month trial service, I can see that we might agree in some cases to a lesser term. By the same token, we might demand and be successful in getting longer trial services for other classifications. The right to say yes is also the right to say no at the bargaining table. And under what is called the reserve rights doctrine, management has all the rights they don't contract away. So if we don't agree with some union to a lesser trial service, we'll set it at whatever trial service we think is necessary.
You'll start the negotiations with 5 years?
No.
I'm only joking.
Right. But you see the point. Once it's actually set, neither side can negotiate what truly fits the given situation.
I just want to get your perspective on the issue. So.
Thanks.
Hey, let me, I don't want to nitpick this at all, but on line 36.
Which page, sir?
On 7. Dependability of the employee did not merit continuance in the service. Now, on the other two, in line 33 and line 34, it's referred to as trial service. Do you think that should refer to trial service there again rather than just service?
No, in the service refers to in the classified service.
Okay, that's... All right.
And also, these are words of art that have been involved in many, many cases. Okay. The Relations Board that I wouldn't like to change.
Okay. Moving along.
Section 16 relates to the rating of employees, the merit rating of employees. And again, we've removed many of the former specifics and simply said that these merit ratings are for the purpose to determine the quality of performance and the relative merit of employees in the classified service. The merit ratings are, of course, picked up in other sections of the Act, and they will, of course, be a part of collective bargaining negotiations relative to the compensation and promotion and layoff, et cetera, of employees. Basically, the matter of merit rating is an effective tool for management, and it's also a requirement of the federal standards.
It's also the trigger by which we determine such things as merit pay increases, layoff, reemployment, promotion, and so forth. So it's a real significant provision of the Act.
Section 17 refers to ORS 240.555, and this is the disciplinary section of the statute. We have not dramatically altered this section, which specifies malfeasance, inefficiency, incompetency, and so forth for the action. We have removed that section which states that we may suspend a regular employee only for a period not exceeding 30 days in any 12 months. We're looking for rapid resolution of all of the grievances between state employees and their labor representatives and the employers. On the other hand, the pre-dismissal procedures that we've been following to take care of the due process rights of regular employees have taken longer than 30 days. And if the individual was under suspension, we've had to suspend them and then bring them back on the job or pay them for not working, which we don't want to do. So we're asking to remove that limitation that would forbid us to suspend an employee for more than 30 days in any 12 months.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rogers.
Senator Day talked about the situation of the chemist and took a year and a half to finally unload him. How is this done to speed up that process?
Well, if you have a property interest in your employment by reason of passing trial service and becoming a regular employee, the employer, the statute currently reads that the employee must appeal to the Employment Relations Board within 10 days of the effective date of the discipline. And the employer, of course, has certain pre-dismissal procedures it has to go through before the action is taken, which the employee then appeals. We're going to speed that up to the greatest extent possible. But once the employee appeals to the Employment Relations Board, and they have to hold a hearing and issue an order, and the employee can then appeal to the Court of Appeals from the order of the Employment Relations Board, just as you could appeal from the order of any administrative agency, that can take some time. And I'm not sure what Senator Day did in that particular instance, but I advise state agencies to fill those jobs in the interim once we've demonstrated a case, and either take the gamble or have a layoff of employees if we should lose the case. We process all of our grievances very rapidly. Terminations, of course, take longer because you can go through the Court of Appeals if you choose, or even indeed up to the Supreme Court. We have one termination in the Supreme Court of the United States.
Which, by the way, is probably the central cause of this particular provision of statute remaining. We had hoped originally to just clean all of this stuff out and handle it all by contract, because it's, frankly, it's a more expeditious manner of doing these kinds of things. One of the problems is that the Supreme Court of the United States has determined that it's not a problem, but it's caused us to be here, is that the Supreme Court has determined that public employees have a property interest in their job and therefore can't be deprived of that pursuant to the 14th Amendment without due process. And that's what this is. It's a due process. And when we got into this part of the bill and the statute talking about how can we speed this up a little bit, it's easier said than done, frankly. And someone who wants to, some public employee who does have that property interest, is past trial service, who wants to appeal their termination, all the way up the ladder is going to do that, and there is nothing in this statute which is going to prevent that. They're going to have the ability to do that.
I would like to ask Bill something. Are you required under your current agreements with your employees to support any employee's case, regardless of value?
We have a situation in the public employment which is a little different than the private sector, and that is that we have, like all unions, a duty of fair representation, which means we have to give them that kind of fair look-see and make sure that we do right by them. But as a result of this property interest, courts have looked at public employee unions a little more carefully in the question of duty of fair representation. We have been sued successfully once for not representing someone, which was an outright loser of a case, but the court said so, but awarded this individual a sum of money because we had failed to represent them. Might add that we were sued today, along with Mr. Holscher in the state, by a fellow in U.S. District Court for a very similar matter. So our attitude on terminations is we will handle almost anybody who walks through the door on the theory that we have an obligation to do that, whether they're members or not, by the way. We also have an obligation to represent anyone in the bargaining unit. So we're pretty careful about that.
I just recall in some early starts in the 73-74 period when there were clear cases where the employee was wrong that the union backed away, and I just wondered if that still was the...
Well, we found that by doing that, we've subjected ourselves to substantial liability, and therefore we've decided not to make those kinds of judgments anymore.
All right.
Section 18.
I got it, Mr. Chairman. I got a kind of a technical question here. In well, I guess I was getting ahead a little bit, but it still relates to Section 17. I better let you say what you're going to say about Section 18 first. Now,
all right. So Section 18 is a combination of two former sections, 245-70, 245-75. Both of which related to employees who were in the classified service and then go into the classified, unclassified service or exempt service. And the section now is really sort of a housekeeping section. It just simply says that after termination of unclassified or exempt service, for reasons other than specified in 240.555, that is misconduct, malfeasance, and so forth, such employees shall be restored to their former status in the classified service. This has been the law for many years, and it was in two different sections, and I combined the sections. No change at all in the effect.
Codification.
I won't ask the question.
Section 6 is Legislative Council's addition. Excuse me, Section 19 is... Legislative Council's addition to make sections 6, 7, and 20 to 24 as a part of the ORS. Section 20 is the first really new section that is that replaces repealed matters, and this is the section that specifies the basic parameters of the merit system that will be developed by unilateral policy of the employer through the personnel division or negotiated with the union for collective bargaining employees. Sub 1 talks about recruiting, selecting, and promoting employees on the basis of their relative ability, knowledge, experience, and skills with open competition statewide and so forth. Two, of course, specifically speaks to the statewide open recruitment for classifications which are common to state agencies and allows for delegation of this recruitment and selection to agencies where the appropriate. Said another way, if you're going to employ truck drivers and secretaries and various classifications that are common to many agencies, we expect this to stay in the personnel division. But if you're in the Fish and Wildlife Commission and you're trying to hire fish and wildlife biologists, we think the best people to hire fish and wildlife biologists are fish and wildlife biologists who can talk to the various colleges and interview the various candidates without going through some personnel division machinery. Subsection 3 speaks to competition for appropriate positions may be limited to facilitate employment of those with substantial physical or mental impairment or who are economically disadvantaged, namely CETAs, or for the purposes of implementing a specified affirmative action program. In other words, we could specifically recruit for
those particular kinds of individuals for the good of the service and limit the competition to individuals within those categories.
This is
Representative Rogers.
This measure we just passed through the House, which allows a trial service period in lieu of an examination for people with certain severe handicaps. That falls within this. Is that the sort of thing that you're looking at in this sub 3?
I haven't seen that piece of legislation, Representative Rogers, but...
Surprise.
Beg your pardon?
Surprise.
Yes. But there's no question that this was intended to allow for non-competitive or at least limited competition for certain kinds of employees based on mental or physical impairment or economically disadvantaged, or we need affirmative action improvement in some area.
Well, that's the reason we just had that, what, Monday?
This week. What is that bill? I'd be glad to check it.
I don't recall the bill number, but it was
yesterday. It was this week.
I think it was this week, anyway. And I'm wondering if there's a real need for that.
I don't know.
With that sub 3 that's included here.
Well, obviously, you've mandated it in certain circumstances. It sounds like that you have, and this was simply an authority to the personnel division to do this.
Also, do we hazard getting some of the reverse discrimination issues involved with this thing now so that we don't end up in the courts by mandating specific numbers? How do we avoid that?
You don't.
Well, as labor counsel, I certainly wouldn't recommend any sort of reverse discrimination situation, but... it is possible in the future that we could have need for certain kinds of recruitment without running into the Bakke reverse discrimination case. Let me give you a simple example. Bakke does not apply in its reverse discrimination aspects if a court has ordered you to correct a situation. No court, thank heaven, has yet ordered us to correct any situations, but if they should, and order us to improve the number of females or improve the number of blacks or other minorities in a given situation, this would be our statutory authority to go ahead and get the job done without running afoul of our merit system.
Well, Bakke said no quotas. He didn't say no affirmative action program.
That's true. Said another way, I think if we just started off tomorrow to say we're not going to hire anything but blacks and we're going to make just a blacklist for affirmative action purposes, we might run into a Bakke problem. But if we were simply being affirmative, trying to get more black candidates, that's perfectly permissible, and it might be permissible if a court has ordered us to solve a certain situation.
There's nothing that we can do, I think you'll agree, to say that there will never could be a reverse discrimination suit. I mean, that potentially is going to be there.
We have them now.
Right. And there isn't anything we could do to prevent that.
No.
I think that does the law certainly require that we have to limit to certain categories of ability, as this would says may be limited. Well, does the law say we have to, in any case, limit to specific types, specifically physical or mental impairment, for employment?
This just gives us authority to do so if we feel the situation is correct for it. Said it to you another way, we have to make a case-by-case judgment as to whether we can do this under Bakke and the other rules and regulations. And this would give us the authority to do so if we felt the time was right.
What's organized labor's deal?
Well, as you say, I think that it's the real question you've got here is you've got two ways to go, and that is whether you wish to lock in a fairly substantial body of statute on this subject, or to create what I think is a real permissive section here, sub 3,
which will allow the executive department in this instance to move into all of these areas, which frankly I think is much more flexible than the current law and much more appropriate, because I think the statutory attempts to really lock in these kinds of programs have been highly unsuccessful. We, I think, are going to be seeing much more on the subject of affirmative action, at least, in collective bargaining agreements. We're just really scratching the surface at it. I think, from what I've observed at least, our union has a little different attitude on the subject than most. We tend to be very supportive of affirmative action programs. I know that OSCA was primarily responsible for the passage, and I can't even remember the number of the bill now, but in 1975, during that session when I was on the other side listening to OSCA, as a matter of fact, introduced and sponsored what is now the state's affirmative action program, and frankly is much weaker than what I envision this will ultimately create. But I think you really need this kind of flexibility to deal with problems like Bakke that you can't legitimately deal with effectively in the statute.
I think they have enough now.
Well, I don't want to get into a discussion on the Bakke case, but by the same token,
I
think there's some arguments as to whether or not that would even apply in hiring. I mean, because there are those that feel very strongly that Bakke only applied to the enrollment at Davis Medical School and Alan Bakke and nothing else. Although there might have been some rumblings in these other areas.
Let me put this a different way and more concretely to you. Forget about Bakke for a second. What if we determine that someone has, in fact, been discriminated against on the basis of sex, color, race, grade, national origin, whatever? We can buy them off. We can pay certain money damages. Say, go find a job for themselves. Or part of the terms and conditions of the settlement might be to put them to work. Now, if we decide to put them to work on the basis that we have discriminated against them, but for their discrimination they might have been employed someplace else, we probably will just order the agency to put them to work, or we'll advise the agency to put them to work and not worry about lists and merit system competition, because we've got a situation that needs being solved.
And a you remedy for that individual.
You don't see this becoming... My concern is that we don't allow state agencies to be the total area from which we resolve the problems of discrimination. In other words, total employment there. And I worry that we're going to start shifting the load if nothing else but by example from the responsibilities of private enterprise and private industry to meet some of those needs. And I just worry that we're going to shift this because it's going to be easier. And that's why I'm coming from with this thing.
I see it as authority to the state to do its fair share, if you will, or...
Okay, I want it on the record.
Yeah.
Okay.
In no way nullifies the statutes that govern private employers.
See, it's easier for
at this point, I want to take a 5-minute recess.
Thank you.
Let everybody and yourself have a break. We'll be right. House Labor Committee, come to order. First, take note of those present, all others are excused. Gentlemen? Let's finally hit that amendment.
All right. Page 8, section 20, subsection 1, referring to recruiting, selecting, and promoting employees, refers to the fact that the selection will be based on relative ability, knowledge, experience, and skills determined by open competition, consideration of qualified applicants without regard to an individual's political affiliation or non-job-related factors. And here's the crucial phrase, without discrimination and with proper regard for an individual's privacy and constitutional rights as a citizen, unquote. That phraseology is at variance to the original draft that was made by the Senate. The committee, we've offered you an amendment, which I hope you have before you, which would...
I'm not sure that I do.
Just like the thing that...
Yeah, one page.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Which would state that on line 37, after the word individuals, it would read race, color, religion, sex, national origin, political affiliation, age, handicap, or other non-job-related factors, and with proper regard for an individual's privacy, unquote. One of the reasons we would like to put the race, color, creed, sex, national origin back into the statute is those are, of course, the words of art that arise up out of federal and other state statutes. They have meaning. There are court interpretations, and to simply combine those into the words without discrimination does injustice to the history behind those words. Plus, every employment decision is a discrimination. You pick the better of two employees, hopefully, and it's only unlawful discrimination that we're talking about, based on race, color, creed, sex, national
origin. But why, for instance, isn't marital status in there? That's in the Oregon statutes on employment discrimination.
There is no
659 has marital status in it. In employment.
659 says that sex will include marital status, if my remembrance is correct.
No, it's spelled out in there. We amended it. So it's sex.
You said earlier on, marital status includes sex.
Well, the problem was that there were court cases that said sex did not include marital status.
Representative, before you, I'm doing this from memory. And
Mike, look in 659 your employment.
We're getting into this thing.
I know sex included.
Can I move the adoption?
Included.
Before we get any deeper into
it. Mr. Chairman, I move the proposed amendment to be adopted in Senate Bill 57A, engrossed on page 8, lines 37 and 38.
Well, they're looking at that. I
know. It has marital status.
Okay, would there be any objections to including marital status?
Nope. No. If it's one of the statutory grounds.
Is that okay?
It is in the Oregon statute.
Why don't we add it after sex?
Yeah.
Whatever. Not before. What?
Right.
That's sex before marital status, man.
I'll put you to mind.
I know the abuse that I am subjected to daily in this committee.
Okay, intergenerational. You're looking at this 1979 archives.
She's thinking about moving over to
the motion is to adopt the amendments proposed by the governor's office and the Oregon State Employees Association, and to include marital status after the word sex. Okay? Is there any objections to the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I
moving along,
would like to just highlight one particular part of this, which I think is significant. It's actually a typographical error. Down on about the fourth or fifth line where it says non-job.
What page,
words.
Bill, and where
the amendment.
I'm talking about the amendment.
Oh, on the amendment?
Non-job should be two words, by the way. Non-job-related factors, I think, is particularly significant. For years, I know that, especially with, I'm thinking particularly in the area of education, state is required, and it's not so bad now as it used to be, but for certain positions, semi-skilled, unskilled positions, required credentials, levels of education that are far exceed the requirements of the position. And what non-job related factors means to me, at least, is that each position will be reviewed specifically with respect to the actual requirements that are necessary to fulfill that job, and nothing more. I think that can cover really a fairly broad subject area, so that we're looking at the requirements for a given position, period, and nothing more.
Not requiring a PhD for a
clerical.
That's right. That's right. Very important.
I just wanted to second that after my concern of, you know, discrimination. A lot of people think that with the civil rights laws that you can't use non-job related requirements, and they don't realize that it's only if it adversely impacts one of these protected categories, then you can't use it. But the classic line has always been like left-handedness. You could, in fact, say that you would not hire left-handed people or blue-eyed people or some completely non-job related arbitrary thing, and I'm glad to see that language in there. Wish it were in our civil rights statute.
What are we doing?
I don't want to touch it anymore.
Okay, so that will also include the paragraph.
I couldn't get the ERA ratified.
Thank you, Representative. Going on to subsection 4 on page 9, starting line 6, appointments to positions of state service shall be made on the basis of qualifications and merit by selection from eligible lists established by the division or a delegated operating agency. Simple authority, replacing a host of previous provisions that related to so many names being certified from certain kinds of lists, etc. Subsection 5.
I noticed that you use eligible lists there and in another place, but those two words have been deleted out of the definition section. That's no problem, I guess, is it?
I don't think so, Representative, because we don't want those.
I think everybody knows what they mean.
Plus, we don't want those lists to mean exactly the same thing as they did before. Before, they were certain kinds of lists, agency versus statewide, and promotion versus open competitive. And we'll be developing, through collective bargaining and otherwise, new kinds of procedures and new kinds of lists, and maybe even some new names for them.
Okay.
Subsection 5, non-competitive selection and appointment procedures may be used for unskilled or semi-skilled positions or where job-related ranking measures are not practical or appropriate. As Bill said, some unskilled jobs, maybe any kind of competitive selection procedure is silly, and we call these registration classes. If we want janitors or if we want certain kinds of individual laborers, we just advertise the paper for them, and people come and apply, and we interview them and hire them, and we don't go through a application review and testing and all the rest.
I think particularly things like the state fair or other, you know, seasonal short-term operations where you need substantial supplies of unskilled labor in a hurry and for a short period of time. That's really what we're talking about.
Subsection 6, minimum qualifications and performance requirements and duties of a classification may be appropriately modified to permit the appointment and promotion of trainees to positions normally filled at full proficiency level. Section 7, the division or delegated agency shall establish systems to provide opportunities for promotion through meritorious service, training, education, career development assignments. The division shall certify to the eligibility of persons selected for promotion or delegation, or delegate that responsibility to operating agencies in appropriate situations. Provision shall be made to bring persons into state service through open competition at higher levels where such competition provides abilities not available among existing employees in which state service contributes to improved employment opportunity for unrepresented groups. Essentially a section to give us the parameters for promotion. Subsection 8, temporary employees may be given non-status appointments without open competition and consideration for a period of less than 1 year in appropriate circumstances. Previously, we could not hire a temporary employee for more than 90 days in any 12 months, and that's simply too short a period of time in some situations. Temporary non-status appointments shall not be used to defeat the open competition and consideration system, and temporary service shall not be used as any portion of a required trial service period. There's the protection not to fill regular full-time jobs with temporary employees who have not gone through some open competition for those positions.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kopetsky.
This doesn't get at the
issue of professional service contracted employees who kind of remain on these professional service contracts for over a year, 2 years, 3 years?
No, it doesn't, because they're really not employees, they're third-party contractors.
Okay, thank you. Independent contractors.
Independent contractors. I speak to the third-party.
Hot subject on
employment. Some of them aren't very independent. They are third-party. They're not employees. They're not common law employees. Section 21, the division shall establish the hours of work, holidays, leaves of absence, with and without pay, and vacations of employees in the state classified service. The division may delegate this responsibility to individual operating agencies where appropriate. Taking away, again, many of the finite previous statutory provisions and rules, and depending upon the collective bargaining process or upon the employer's unilateral standard setting for unrepresented employees for these matters of wages and hours and other kind of conditions of employment.
Could you go back over something?
Yes.
Line 16 through 18, starting with provisions shall be made. I get concerned when you get down to the last four words there, or five words. Tell me what you're trying to say.
Well, we've said already that Section 7 is a promotion authority section, and we've indicated clearly that we expect promotion to come from the ranks for the Maine through enrichment programs and training and development and all of that, but we've also recognized there will be situations in which we'll have to employ people from the outside on open competitive basis at the higher levels where we don't have the skills we need within the people who are currently our employees. And further, in terms of affirmative action programs where you have plenty of underrepresented minorities in your workforce, but they're not distributed throughout your circumstance, it may be more expeditious to go out and employ through affirmative action programs individuals already trained at those higher levels than it would be to take 5 years to move people up through the bottom.
Yeah, I just thought that was, but I wanted to be sure that I understood.
Thank you, Representative. Subsection, Section 22.
Mr. Chairman. I'm 21, but
yes, sir.
The word just says the division shall establish holidays. Do you mean paid holidays?
Yes.
Isn't that so state? This says you can just declare a holiday, doesn't it?
Well, the unions, you know, might ask for 13 holidays, and we'll offer 12 paid and one unpaid. Again, the authority I'm asking you for is the authority to say no as well as the authority to say yes.
All right.
Section 22, delegations of authority and responsibility to operating agencies shall be subject to appropriate post-audit review by the division. This is the general catch-all post-audit review section. Controversies between operating agencies and division arising from post-audit review shall be resolved by the director of the executive department. Avoiding then the quarrel between an agency and the personnel division being taken down to the Employment Relations Board. The authority and responsibilities in the executive department, and that's where we think the resolution should be made. Section 23 relates first in subparagraph 1 to persons initially appointed to permanent or seasonal positions of state service shall be subject to a trial service period.
Can I back you up?
Please.
Back to Representative Starr's comment there. The division shall establish the hours of work, holidays, work, comma, holidays, comma, leaves of absence with and without pay and vacation. Wouldn't it, to clarify what you just stated, wouldn't it be clearer if we said hours of work, comma, holidays, and leaves of absence with and without pay?
If you somehow number one, we're doing a series of items which are either to be set or negotiated, and we put the and between the second to the last one and the last one, you know, in normal fashion. The rest of them are just separated by commas. You put the and between those two, you somehow relate holidays and leaves of absence together. Indeed, they're both conceivably time off the job with pay, or conceivably without pay.
Our position is there is no such thing as an unpaid holiday. Because if you're required to take the day off for some reason and not pay for it, that's a layoff, essentially. I mean, that's what kind of a holiday is that?
I'd rather answer
good news and bad news.
I'd rather answer that in the terminology of labor relations, holidays and leaves of absence are two different things.
Yeah, okay, I agree with you there. I was trying to tie it to the with and without pay.
I'm just trying to think of the public contracting statutes. I think on the Veterans Day, Steve Telfer may be able to help us. That's a holiday, but it's one without pay, or it's discretionary.
All of our holidays are with pay, and if we're required to take a day off and we're not paid for it, we're going to call it something different, I guarantee you that, because we're going to tell the people that we represent we got them another holiday. The bad news is you don't get paid for it.
Your intent is for the with and without pay to address both.
No,
holidays
to address only leave of absence.
Okay. All right. I'll leave one on the floor.
Thank you, Representative. Section 23, persons initially appointed to a permanent seasonal position in state service shall be subject to a trial service period. Of course, the length unspecified. Any employee who serves the trial service period designated by the division or a delegated operating agency for a given classification shall be given regular employee status. That's the property right point in time. Subsection 2, employees who have acquired regular status will not be subject to separation except for cause defined by 245.55, that's the malfeasance, misconduct, and so forth, or lack of work, curtailment of funds, or reorganization requiring a reduction in force, namely all of those three being layoffs. 3, procedures shall be established by the division to provide for the layoff and opportunity for reemployment of employees separated for reasons other than cause, which shall take into account the needs of the service, qualifications, quality of performance, relative merit, and length of service. I think, as you know, the current rules, the current collective bargaining agreements, have layoff and reemployment based on a combination of years of service and merit rating. Subsection 4, procedures shall also be established by the division for the transfer, discipline, or demotion of employees for the good of the service, or separation of employees whose conduct or performance continues to be improper or inadequate after reasonable attempts have been made to correct it where appropriate. This might be termed a progressive discipline section. Subsection 5, no employee shall be subject to disciplinary action or separation for disclosure, not prohibited by law, of violations of laws, rules, or other improper actions or inefficiency of superior officers or fellow employees. The division shall establish a procedure whereby employees may report wrongdoing or inefficiency to an independent agency. Prohibitions, protections against employee reprisals, and an appeal procedure for employees who suffer reprisal because of their disclosure. Representative Sajon said this was the whistleblower section. I think of it as broader than that. This not only is a place for employees to go to blow the whistle, but it's also a place for the executive department to hear directly from employees their feelings about their individual operating agency, and to allow the executive department to investigate those feelings and to determine whether the agency is indeed being administered in a proper fashion.
Okay, let me, on that point, we were talking about it earlier, the suggestion, I want to throw this out to make it kind of clarify that and make it a little more readable, is to break those two provisions into a sub A and B. Now here on line, let's start on line 3. Now, line two, the division shall establish a procedure whereby employees, etc. If we, and I'm thinking of something along this line, the division shall establish procedures, semicolon, whereby employees, A, or sub A, whereby employees may report wrongdoing or inefficiency, and then a sub B, and prohibitions and protections against employee reprisals, etc.
And then sub C for the appeal procedure.
And an appeal, right. How's that?
If you wish to do that.
Do you think that would help to clarify it a little, make it more, a little more readable? Better.
Well, since I wrote this, I love the phraseology the way it is. But if the committee thinks it would read better to break that up in A, B, and C, I, as a lawyer, repel against C subsection A above, which doesn't apply to subsection C below, because then I have to keep reading sections. And I go for just simple English sentences, even if badly constructed.
Or an idea. What are these words?
But I'm figuring I won't need an attorney if we change to read it to me.
Kevin, I wonder if this independent agency, who is the independent agent?
Well, I hope that it certainly would be independent of the agency the employee works for, whether it's independent of the executive department or not.
You are going to establish this through negotiation? Or?
We had initially, in fact, Representative Zijan said earlier, we talked prior to the session about this kind of legislation, which has been popularized on the national level and through several other state acts. And had talked preliminarily with the governor's office about this idea. And their comment at the time was that maybe the appropriate place to begin something like this would be in the office of ombudsperson. And I think that's an interesting thought. It's in the governor's office so that you've got the authority and power that you need to get the job done. And it's independent of various operating agencies. One of the objections I might have to the executive department, frankly, is that I suspect that may be an agency where you would have some someone taking part as a result of this particular obviously it's got to be independent of that person's work environment, otherwise it's not going to instill a kind of confidence in them. They need to do it as they want to say. But I don't see that necessarily being negotiated. Except that we do handle grievances on the basis of people.
All right. Well, reason I ask this, one is you hadn't identified it, and two, it may reduce a few of the complaints that I get from state employees, in which I have to then go back through someone.
Representative Rogers, not to negotiate with Bill on what kind of an agency would be set up, I don't see this as replacing the governor's ombudsman, but rather to be a place where we can, that is we, management, the administration of state service, can find out what complaints employees have. It's what you do with this information. If there's a criminal complaint, obviously we're going to turn that over immediately to the Attorney General or to the District Attorney. If it's a management complaint, it might involve labor relations, in which case the Director of Labor Relations, myself, or whoever will be dealing with it, with the collective bargaining representative. If it's a complaint relative to some employee or some citizen not receiving a merit system matter, it might go to the administrator's personnel division. So I'm not sure if it's, quote, an independent agency that's singular.
Mm-hmm. The problem that I always have is when I get one of those complaints, I'm thinking fairly recently, I contact someone within that agency because this is a complaint about the way something is handled. Complain to that agency. They do whatever investigation they do, and then they report back to me. but I really never have any way of knowing whether this thing was resolved appropriately or not. Now, if it's within the executive department, since they have the ultimate power over the very head of that agency, somewhere I would think perhaps they might resolve it better than I could.
That's where I see it, is in the executive department, but as I've already indicated, there might be some multiple places for it, depending on what the complaint okay. is. Section 24 is the appointment of a director of labor relations who would be appointed by and serve at the pleasure of the director of the executive department. And secondly, and more importantly, it centralizes, if you will, collective bargaining between the state and its agencies through the director of labor relations for all certified and recognized bargaining units of classified employees. Subsection 2 of this section is maybe the most important section relative to the labor representatives, which states that notwithstanding the provisions of 240.235, 240.430, and sections 20, 21, and 23 of this 1979 Act, employees of state agencies who are in certified or recognized appropriate bargaining units shall have all aspects of their wages, hours, and other terms and conditions of employment determined by collective bargaining agreements between the state and its agencies and the exclusive representative employee representatives of such employees pursuant to the Collective Bargaining Act, except with regard to recruitment and selection of applicants for initial appointment to state service, and by reason of the subsections which have been excluded, also except with regard to the development of the classification plan. This is a highly important section because where we have eliminated the specifics from the old statute, we must now go back into collective bargaining to establish those specifics for bargaining unit employees, and we've eliminated out recruitment and selection and the classification plan because those really apply to the citizens of the state of Oregon and not just to the employees in the bargaining unit.
Representative Rogers.
Would this be an appropriate place to put an amendment that says that when employees of some state agency are merged with the employees of another state agency, they would still retain a bargaining unit? I'm thinking of the merger of the Fish and Wildlife, which I don't know whether that's resolved yet or not, but I'll tell you. That has been a thorn under my fingernails for a while.
Well, the merger, the attrition, the splitting, the clarifying of bargaining units follows a 30-year history of the National Labor Relations Board, and it's administered by the Employment Relations Board. In the case of Fish and Wildlife, the employees voted as to whether to be represented in a single unit after the merger, and they voted by a majority not to be so represented. It was the Employment Relations Board who made the determination that based on the standard factors of, quote, community of interest, unquote, that a single unit was appropriate. They could just as easily have decided that two units of the former employees of each of those two agencies were appropriate, and in which case elections would have been held separately. I think that, if you'll allow me, Bill, I think the main reasons, as I handle the case, that they determined that a single agency was appropriate. I think the board felt that's what the legislature wanted, was a single agency of essentially interchangeable employees who no longer thought of themselves as fish or as wildlife, but together in a single agency.
Having three fish hatcheries in my district makes me very aware of the fish part of that. Not too concerned about the wildlife, so they're scattered around.
This is very unfamiliar with the wildlife.
We learned a very important lesson during that whole process, and know Jeff's employees were quite frustrated, justifiably so, as a result of all that. We've developed a kind of some boilerplate language that I walk the halls with and tack on to every agency merger bill that I can find. To give you an example, I don't know, did you get Senate Bill 255 here, the SAFE? Exempted them from the merit system. Well, by definition, that would have eliminated our bargaining unit there, because our bargaining unit is defined as all classified employees. All of a sudden, there aren't any. So we were successful in having an amendment adopted which said that this will not change the bargaining unit and so forth. And sometimes you learn the tough way, and that provided a very good example of that.
Yeah, so you think it's being appropriately taken care of now?
Yeah, I think you would have a terrible time trying to draft an amendment which would solve that problem. But we're real aware, painfully.
I just like to point out a couple of things. I think Bill's correct. This is really the guts of the concept of this whole measure. ORS 240-235, which is one of the not withstood provisions, is the merit pay section. ORS 244-30 is the merit rating section, which is the evaluation. Section 20, 21, and 23 are all of those enumerated items which are required by the federal act in terms of the merit principles. And the idea is this. It says, notwithstanding those provisions, we'll negotiate all the terms and conditions of employment. And the question is, does that expand the scope of bargaining? Well, it expands it beyond what exists now, because obviously there are certain things that we do not negotiate that are covered in statute. We will not negotiate anything with respect to recruitment and selection of applicants for initial appointment to state service, and don't want to. So there's no reason not to specify that clearly in the statute. What it says is that we're going to negotiate virtually everything within the parameters of the federal merit regulation. Now, we can't exceed those, because if we do, the federal government is going to say, we want our money back. And I'm sure they'll let us know that in great hurry, and we're aware of those principles, and we have no desire to exceed them. But given one of those one or two sentence very broad principles, there is considerable latitude for negotiation about how those are adhered to by the state of Oregon, how they are applied to state service. And that's what we're looking for. And so what this section really does is just say that you've got an option here. You've got one system or you've got the other system, but you're not going to have both. Right? Showed this example to someone else, which I think is a fairly good. We have a collective bargaining agreement. This is what it looks like. This thick. It's kind of a thin little booklet. It'll probably be a little thicker next time around, but not much. And after 1981, an employee who is represented by us or by one of the other unions will but have to look at a document of this nature and identify their trouble area in a real hurry, and understand whether they have a problem or not, and what to do about that problem. As opposed to right now, where you have to consult this, you have to consult your agency contract, which may be equally as thick, and a little book that's about like this, full of state merit system law, regulations, rules, precedent cases, and other such things. And our goal, frankly, is that each employee, each state manager, can have a document of this size and solve the problem in a real hurry. And I think that this subsection probably strikes closer at that than any other state or subdivision in the country. And that's really the guts of the whole measure, as I see it.
Two more subsections, two section 24.
I might say the session starts at 4 o'clock. Anybody here carrying a bill or one of the officers that are up
there? I haven't got any bills. First one.
First one up? was going to suggest we could get excused for a few minutes longer in order to go through this.
We're almost finished, really.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and we'll see how we
do. If he's not there, then
call a halt whenever you're
at the foot of the challenge.
Subsection 3 indicates that provisions or rules adopted by the division, that is, the personnel rules, subjects of which are incorporated in the collective bargaining agreement, should not be applicable to employees within the collective bargaining units covered by the agreement. In other words, we don't have the power to agree in a collective bargaining agreement and then issue a contrary personnel rule and wipe out our agreement, as handy as that might be sometimes. Subsection 4,
as handy as it is right now,
the division shall assure the speedy resolution of employee grievances by adopting a grievance procedure resulting in final employer determination within 60 days of filing a written grievance, and thereafter appeal to the board, that is the Employment Relations Board, the Civil Rights Division of the Bureau of Labor, or appropriate review agency. Employees in collective bargaining units shall have their grievances resolved as provided for by the collective bargaining agreement, which might include your biggest guy against our biggest guy, or binding arbitration, or
Doyle
whatever. Subsection 25 amends 24696 and goes back to the matter of centralizing collective bargaining. States that the Executive Department of the State of Oregon shall represent all state agencies which have bargaining units in collective bargaining negotiations with certified or recognized exclusive representatives of all appropriate bargaining units of exempt, unclassified, or classified employees, except those unclassified employees governed by the provisions of ORS 240-240. Which relates to higher education professors and a couple of others, Office of Secretary of State, and so forth. The Executive Department may delegate such collective bargaining responsibility to operating agencies as may be appropriate. We currently have 86 or so bargaining units, and we have negotiations with 15 different unions, and the Director of Labor Relations, of course, will have the responsibility to centralize this. He'll have the authority to either bargain himself or delegate that responsibility to the agency level where appropriate.
The rest of it is just reference checks.
Yeah, Section 26
almost the rest of the bill, in fact, is our reference check.
Yeah, those are all sections added by the Legislative Council, not matters which we prepared, to the best of my knowledge.
They went through the did a stairs check and just went through and changed references and did all the appropriate.
Okay, so that's all the rest of it is, and is that correct?
Well, except for the final section, which is the effective date, and that's significant in that there are four things which will become effective within 90 days, no emergency clause. The new provision for the appointment of the Personnel Division Administrator, which would become effective, I assume, in October if you get out of here in July sometime. The appointment of the Director of Labor Relations, which would become effective immediately. And then in Section 37, you see ORS 240-150 and 240-365. Those are outmoded certification procedures. One is a thing called a pre-audit of payroll, which is unnecessary, and B, has not been followed for many years, and 240-365, which requires a certification of employment lists, which means an actual certified list of people, and contributes substantially to the slow process of filling vacancies.
So they're just not used anymore.
No.
No.
Mr. Chair,
well, the one is used, and that is causing great problems.
Well, okay, yeah. That's the list?
Yes.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, were they afterthoughts? Why weren't they in Section 1 bill?
Well, because the rest of the bill becomes effective July 1, 1981. These would become effective in October.
Those two repeals would be immediate. Passage of the bill. I'd like to conclude just to simply say to you that based on my five going on 6 years of representing the state, this bill will work. we've got just as much power to say no as yes, as I pointed out a couple of times. I personally reviewed this bill with Mr. McBride of the Federal Civil Service Board in Seattle, and with a couple of places where he's a little wheezy, he thinks that the bill meets all of the federal standards. The only recommendation he made to me, and has made it in writing, is that we adopt a savings clause, he calls it, in which it is said that if anything under this bill or the collective bargaining process that follows violates federal law, well, then it's void. And I suggest that's the law anyway, and I see no need to amend it.
We have one of those in our contract and have for some time as well.
Okay, it's not actually in the bill.
No.
Okay, but basically the federal civil rights people have that good show.
Well, not civil rights people.
Civil service.
That's correct.
Yeah. Right. Correct.
Lieutenant.
Representative.
In section 34, that refers to the commissioner. That section, that chapter is the public utility commissioner, isn't it?
Again, this is one of those legislative council.
Commissioner for the blind, is it, or what?
This is one of those legislative council amendments that goes back to the repeal of the section.
It has reference to chapter 240.
Yeah,
somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
245-65. It's okay. The last sentence in that section.
I'm going to look those up and see what it is. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Are there any questions right now?
I have a question, Mr. Chairman, about the fiscal impact of this. In first place, it's almost unbelievable, but finally, here is that there would be no effect on revenues, no effect on state budget, and there is an exception to that, and that's the vacation accrual, so there's the dollar figure with that. But you don't anticipate saving any money with this by anything? It really kind of leaves things as a status quo in that regard.
Well, Representative Rogers, I didn't prepare any fiscal statements because that's not my responsibility, but obviously we've got a big job ahead of us the next 2 years to negotiate out what had been previously set by a 20-year history of merit system, and it's going to be a lot of work. I think the official position of the executive department is that some of the people who are now doing some of the positions that are now being used by the personnel division will be converted into use by the director of labor relations. In the long run, the collective bargaining works as it I think has for the last 5 years. Yes, money is saved by the resolution of disputes rather than endless battles, and hopefully money is saved by more efficient employee workforce, by better managed workforce, but there isn't any great saving that I know of by the elimination of a bunch of positions, but rather this bill gives us a lot of work to do in the next 2 years.
There's no additional funds will be required because of the merit portion of this.
Well, that won't become effective anyway until 81. Well,
that's right. That's followed by normally they show some funds required for 81, 83 by the vacation computation.
I'd say that our current settlement, of course, calls for a merit pay plan by July 180, but it would have to be a plan within the resources already appropriated to the agency.
Okay, on page 10, though, the amendments I was talking about and breaking that up into A, B, and C subs, I think we know what we want there. If there are no objections, we will consider that amendment adopted conceptually, and then when we come back next week, we'll
break it down into line items.
Yeah, just three, A, B, and C. I can't think of anything else. Anything else? Okay, we'll put this up for work
well, if you've been in work session, put it up for final action Wednesday.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate it very much.
We got to go to work in the other room now, so we are recessed until immediately after session.
Now, I've got a...
Okay, William.
It's a seminar session.
6 o'clock.